Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, here from Chicago, Illinois. In today's podcast, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Joe Saunders. He is the CEO and co-founder of a company called RunSafe Security. Joe, thank you for your time. Let's go ahead and get started, please.
Yeah, thank you, Robbie. I look forward to the conversation. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, our honor. Tell us about RunSafe Security and the purpose of your company and what you're really trying to achieve with it.
Yeah, so RunSafe Security is a cybersecurity company, and we protect embedded software deployed across critical infrastructure. And we do that by adding in security protections into the software that doesn't change the functionality of your code or add new software agents or slow down the performance in any way. What we do is we add in security without slowing down developers. And so the problem we solve is a long-time problem that the industry has faced, which is code weaknesses that get introduced into software as part of the software development process that can lead to some of the most devastating kinds of attacks across critical infrastructure. And that is solving issues related to memory safety and software. And so it is the type of weakness that a foreign adversary or, an attacker can use to take remote control and execution of your software and do things with your software that it wasn't intended to do in the first place. So these kinds of weaknesses in code are exploited that lead to ransomware and exfiltrating data and steering, say, for example, drones off its course and all sorts of kind of nefarious things. And what we've done is we've figured out a way to thwart the attackers so those exploits fail.
Okay, sounds great. Excellent. Now, do you have any examples of customer use case studies or any other client testimonials that you can share with us, please?
Yeah, we are protecting a number of different kinds of applications across critical infrastructure. We're protecting anything from firmware that gets deployed on Dell and HP servers to engine controllers that go on dual-use aircraft to protecting software deployed across weapons programs for the Department of Defense. And also, we're protecting software that's used in electric vehicle charging stations and similar kinds of applications. So there's a number of applications. If you think about anything that's connected, that is using some kind of digital means to automate processes, oftentimes that software has these kinds of vulnerabilities, and that's exactly what we tend to solve. So we work with the product manufacturers. One of our clients is Schneider Electric, and we're protecting software that's used in industrial automation manufacturing systems, as well as, assets that are used in energy infrastructure. And so with that, there's any number of customers we have and a bunch of use cases. And at the end of the day, if you are in aerospace or defense or energy or medical devices or anything that produces software that goes on to some kind of, cyber physical system, it's a good candidate for us to protect. So we're focused in on the industrial IoT and operational technology aspects of critical infrastructure to eliminate, the ability to exploit that software.
So would that include like the nuclear facilities, railways, water supply, oil and gas, that kind of thing?
Yeah, all of those are great examples as well, and we do work in those industries. And, really, if you think about anything that provides, basic services to maintain a well-functioning society, our goal is to help those systems maintain resilience so that we don't have an unintended disruption in service or, so we can thwart anyone who might be wishing to take down that service by way of cyber attack. So those are all great use cases for us as well.
Excellent. Now, how have you approached the IP strategy, protecting intellectual property and your patent portfolio development?
Yeah, it's been one of our core strategies from the start is our engineering team has a pretty deep background supporting both government and commercial entities doing working on both sides of the equation, cyber offense and cyber defense. And so we as a company have some really good know-how in terms of adding in our security protections without changing the behavior of software and without adding software agents and things like that. And so we've found a way to insert into the software development process in a really kind of novel way. But it's, the original ideas were born out of know-how of our engineers that came from government programs and the like. And they really thought about what approach to thwarting attackers would be most relevant to the kinds of things they looked at when they were on the cyber offensive side of the equation. And with that, we decided that there is, tremendous value in that know-how. But what we want to do is build, as we go through and deploy our technology and think about where do we want to go next with our customers, we've thought about an intellectual property portfolio strategy, if you will, that has that know-how at the center. And then we kind of overlaid what else people may have patents around that, in that related area. And we saw a number of opportunities where there were kind of gaps that were needed. And an example of that is simply deploying our technology is one thing, but making it usable for customers is another. And so we thought through and patented ways to support our technology that get deployed out in the field, ways to test our technology once our security protections are built in, and ways we can generate other kinds of solutions by virtue of where we insert into our security protections in the software development process. So we've not only developed patents in the areas where we've deployed and the technology we've built, but in areas around there, kind of the ancillary services connected to the core know-how and the core engine that we built. And for that, we've filed 15 patents over the years.
Oh, wow.
8 of them have been issued thus far, and 3 more are going to be issued this year, I suspect. And then the balance will, are earlier in the patent life cycle. So, we've taken a very active approach to that patent strategy and how it complements the know-how originally of the team in terms of what we built.
Congratulations on those patents.
Thank you.
I know they're very hard to get, actually. I had a friend of mine that got one, and it took him quite a number of years to get that. So, anyway, software bill of materials, can you explain what that is exactly and how it's useful or how can it be used for, software development or even embedded software development?
Yeah, sure. A software bill of materials is really a listing, just like you might get a listing of a bill of materials in a hardware system that you receive. If you receive, a shipment and you open up the contents and there's a bill of materials in there, all the components that comprise, the hardware that you purchased could be listed on a sheet. And the software bill of materials is really the same idea. It's all enumerating all of the individual components and where they possibly came from that comprises your software product or your software packages. And so we have one client, for example, that makes a very lightweight, simple piece of software that does some very powerful things. And I'll protect their name to protect their identity a little bit. But that software piece, the point of the story is that that's used across hundreds of thousands of deployments in critical infrastructure. And that, lightweight software package, if you will, has over 1,000 individual components. And of those 1,000 individual components, 800 of those components come from the open source community. And really, the product manufacturer writes about 200 of the 1,000 components on that relatively simple software solution that they've built. And so a software bill of materials would enumerate all 1,000 of those individual components list out where those components come from. Do they come from the open source community? Do they come elsewhere? And a couple years ago, the Biden administration, in an executive order, said that it will be required to deliver a software bill of materials if you ship software to the U.S. government. So naturally, this customer and many other customers of ours have a need to create this listing. And it's really a powerful starting point to understand not just what's in my software, those 1,000 individual components, but you can do some additional value add to that SBOM, if you will. You can identify the vulnerabilities associated with it, and you can identify which of those vulnerabilities you can, employ various forms of remediation to reduce the attack surface. And so from our perspective, an SBOM is a great starting point in the embedded software industry to understand all the components that comprise your software packages and what the corresponding vulnerabilities are associated with those components and how you might go about reducing the attack surface and reducing the ability of an attacker to exploit that software. So we think the SBOM is an essential starting point to understand what's in your software so you can begin to really comprehend how you should prioritize what vulnerabilities you ought to address in the first place.
Okay, excellent. Now, memory safety, that's becoming an integral, news headline today, with the, with products coming from China and, and God knows what, spy materials they put in memory or whatever. What is the U.S. government doing right now with regards to that aspect?
Yeah, it's actually for me, very, very exciting what the government's doing. So memory-based vulnerabilities have riddled, software since the 70s or 80s. Ever since we first started getting massive adoption of embedded compiled code written in C and C++ deployed across critical infrastructure, memory-based vulnerabilities have caused problems. And in fact, those memory-based vulnerabilities comprise over 40% of all the vulnerabilities that are known in software that get published by, places like CISA, who publishes the CVEs that, in terms of release updates, they publish the CVEs associated with software that is deployed across critical infrastructure. And so 40% of the vulnerabilities are memory-based vulnerabilities. Over the past year, there's been multiple steps that has shown that the U.S. government really understands the importance to solve these vulnerabilities. And it's because these are the basic building blocks on which these, insidious weaknesses in software can be used to generate the most devastating kinds of attacks in critical infrastructure and in software in general. And so the government has done a couple things. The U.S. Congress has appropriated money for the Defense Department to solve memory-based vulnerabilities in weapons programs so they can remain resilient. The NSA has come out with guidance in November of 22 that says that we must solve memory-based vulnerabilities either by deploying memory-safe code or other forms of mitigation. And then the Office of National Cyber Director, which is a new office within the Executive Office of the President, and the National Cyber Director now reports directly to the President. And the Office of National Cyber Director came out with the new National Cybersecurity Strategy document in March 23, which is several dozen pages. And there's one line in there that's an important line. It says we have to solve memory safety in software. And then CISA, part of Department of Homeland Security, has come out with, its Secure by Design, Secure by Default initiative, and that is intended to help solve memory safety. So over the past year, the government has decided that it's very important to address memory-based vulnerabilities in software. And the reason they are doing so, the reason it's so urgent, goes back to something that Director Jen Easterly said on March 1st of this year, 2023, in a speech at Carnegie Mellon. And she said that if we don't solve memory-based vulnerabilities in software, especially across critical infrastructure, if China attacks Taiwan over the next few years, there is likely a simultaneous cyber set of attacks on U.S. critical infrastructure that could be targeting those very vulnerabilities. So CISA, the NSA, the Office of National Cyber Director, and even Congress have recognized over this past year that solving memory safety is inherent to solving critical infrastructure resiliency that we all need in order for a well-functioning society. So it's become a very urgent thing and a very important thing. And, you know, for companies like RunSafe, it's very exciting to see that the kind of problem that we've been working on for several years now is something that the government really wants to get involved in and solve once and for all, since it's been, you know, really one of the cornerstones for attackers to compromise our software over the past several decades.
Excellent. Now, let's kind of segue over to the business side of stuff here. Now, obviously, you know, you've started your company, I've started mine, and we've been in business for quite a long time. What advice do you have to give to other people, like maybe who are in a job right now and they kind of want to do their own thing and they want to start their own cyber business? What advice do you have to give them, or lessons, I should say?
Sure, yeah. First of all, I would encourage anybody to take the leap, especially if you have some ideas that, you know, you think are unique and novel and could build a great business. And certainly there's different kinds of questions. Are you building a product, a technology-based product? Are you building a services company? You know, and really understanding what you are trying to accomplish and what that problem is you're going to solve. I think it all starts with, what is the problem you're going to solve? And you have to think about, you know, how big is that problem, how pervasive, who cares about it, and who are those ideal customer profiles, and who are those personas who would work with you as customers to address the problems and to employ your solutions, whether, again, they're services or, you know, problems and or products. And in my particular case, I have focused in on software technology and software products. And I've embarked on a couple different things that have really guided me as part of building the company. And those include some pillars that we've shared across our company in terms of how we go about building the business that we do. And we really have kind of three core areas that we focus on. And one is that, you know, we believe that there is, you know, in order to be a high growth company, you really need to figure out how to, you know, solve problems without humans' hands getting in the way, without, you know, people getting into the process. And so we've built our technology to add in security protections by automating all the steps that our software does so that our customers can deploy our technology in minutes without human intervention. And we think that's one critical way is to build a great company, is to have a foundation where the technology works and is easy to deploy and doesn't require, you know, one-off support and services and customization and things like that that might, you know, get in the way of the ability of someone to deploy the technology. The second thing is we've taken what I call a 3 and then a 10 and then an N for infinity approach to product development. And that is when we think about the products that we think have infinite potential users out there, if you will, we first start with the first 3 and really try to understand the complete set of issues that those customers have, you know, not just the initial kind of hypothesis, what we think the problem is, but the full set of considerations from the customer's perspective. So really working with 3 core customers at first to get things right is essential. And then once you do that, then you can kind of build the next version of your product and get the next 10 customers. And then with those 10 customers, then, you know, you might be in a really good spot to scale for infinite. But if you break it down in those phases, then suddenly, you know, a big vision that you have of, say, for example, solving memory safety becomes a set of milestones that are achievable, and they're in alignment with understanding and learning about the problem from the customer's perspective. So 3-10-N has been, you know, kind of a key part of our strategy. And then there's two remaining things. So One of those are sort of lessons I've learned along the way, and one of them is learning from your mistakes. And so internally I have, when new employees join and we go through kind of the orientation and onboarding process, I have something I call the School of Hard Knocks, and it's the 25 toughest lessons I've had to learn in my career, or the mistakes I've made that, and what I've learned from them. And I try to share those 25 stories by way of example, because, you know, we want people that are willing to take some risk and may make a mistake along the way. And it's okay to make a mistake as long as we learn from it. And so, you know, learning from our mistakes is kind of a core aspect of our company culture. And with that, we also like the idea of, you know, people getting involved and not just having good strategies, but there's kind of a badge of honor we call plowing the dirt with your face. And I think starting a company it's kind of a metaphor for starting a company. You have to get out there and you kind of pave the way, and pave it by interacting with people. You know, in the lean startup world, they call it get out of the office, and I call it plowing the dirt with your face. And the idea is you need to go, interact with folks, talk about the issues, you know, learn from the mistakes, focus in on where are you in that 310N, and focus in on really building that product that's going to scale. So, you know, I think it's as much about the idea and the problem you're solving as it is about the company culture and the principles and the pillars on which you build the company. And I found if you can be very clear about, you know, all those things I just described, then there's a common share of values that everyone has in the organization. They can buy into that. And then that creates a resilient organization that's willing to kind of push the envelope. They know the standards in which we want to operate, in terms of solution definition. And they're empowered to go make things happen in the spirit of the direction we want to go as a company. So I think not just solving the problem, but thinking about the company and how you want the company to operate, it really emanates from those foundational pieces, and that sets the tone for a great culture and, I think, a great company in the long run.
Excellent. Now, you do podcasting yourself too. How tell us about your podcast and how you decided to kind of do your own version of audio content.
Yeah, so the podcast we have builds on that core foundation, learning from our mistakes in the School of Hard Knocks. And so we have a podcast called Lessons from the School of Security Hard Knocks. And my colleague, Alex O'Shea, who's the producer of that podcast, she really had the idea to take some of those lessons that we have shared internally and some of that internal stuff we do as part of, you know, building our company culture around learning from our mistakes. And she had the idea that it'd be a great idea to turn that external and interview security leaders and some of their toughest mistakes in the cyber battlegrounds, or more generally the security battlegrounds. And so, that has really fueled our podcast, has given it a purpose. And so we go out and talk to, you know, leaders in government, leaders in industry, leaders in think tanks, leaders in cybersecurity in general. We featured the chief security officer of major telecommunications companies, and we've talked to people from TikTok and from the NSA and from, other parts of government. And, you know, we've really learned, you know, not just what they're doing today, but how they got to where they are and the kind of mistakes or bumps in the road that they experienced that made them the security leader that they are. So our podcast is built around the theme of learning from the mistakes, just like we want to do internally at RunSafe, but we feature what the security leaders are doing. And, you know, in a lot of cases, just like anybody trying to make it in this world, you know, there are bumps in the road, and it's really encouraging to hear very successful security leaders talk about times they got knocked down and had to pick themselves up and what they learned from it and how we all can learn from them. And so that's the podcast. It's called Lessons from the School of Security Hard Knocks. And I have to credit Alex for taking that concept internally and repurposing it to the broader community and audience.
Excellent. Now, tell us about your employee reward or award called Courage and Conviction.
Yeah, so it gets back to, you know, learning from our mistakes and company culture. And I worked for a gentleman named George Moore, and he really helped me kind of grow up as a business professional. And all the people I worked with at Target Central, I think, would say the same thing. George had this way of touching everybody in the organization and teaching them, you know, things that he's learned through the School of Hard Knocks and whatnot. And George built a really powerful company and a really successful company. And I think most people in Targus Info would say that was one of the best professional experiences they've had. And part of it is, you know, the friendships, part of it's the success, but really part of it was the culture that George set. And he would have these funny lines that he would say that a lot of times didn't make sense on the surface, but there was like a brilliant genius behind them. One example is, if you want people to go to first base, you have to start running the second base, which as a baseball fan, that makes no sense. But he also, you know, liked to use the phrase, have the courage of your convictions. But he always had a twist to it. And his twist was, have the courage of your convictions, but don't lose the deal. You know, as if you're a salesperson, you're going to lose an opportunity. And what he didn't mean was do anything to win the deal. He meant do everything so that you're in the best possible position to win the deal, or the opportunity to close the contract. And that is, you know, listen to the customer, understand the requirements, understand their needs, understand what they're trying to do, understand how you can help them, and understand the value you bring to them, and make sure that value is, there's a common understanding between you and the customer that there is significant value for you to bring. And so, so courage and conviction became sort of part of the RunSafe company culture. But even more so, George started the Virginia Distillery Company and created American whiskey. And really, he and his son, his wife, have helped create a new category of whiskey in the U.S. George came from Ireland. And unfortunately, George passed away about almost 10 years ago now. And his son has kept operating the business, and Angela, George's wife, is chairman of that company. And so between Angela and Gareth, they operate the Virginia Distillery Company. And they came out with a whiskey called Courage and Conviction. One, because, you know, George touched a lot of people with sort of his great lessons in industry. And I know Gareth, growing up, was always kind of encouraged to have the courage of his convictions. And so at RunSafe, we decided to give out an employee award called the Courage and Conviction Award. And it's for a RunSafe employee who kind of exemplifies the idea of, you know, having the courage of your conviction and seeing it through and standing up, you know, despite adversity, despite, you know, perhaps criticism from time to time, perhaps people challenging that you weren't necessarily doing the right thing, and only to kind of, you know, see it through. And, you know, maybe you learned a lesson along the way and you changed what you ultimately did slightly, or you learned as you went, but having that courage and conviction to take on that risk, to take on that, you know, initiative, to take on that solution, to propose that idea. And so every year we recognize an employee who has most exemplified the spirit of courage and conviction, the way George would be proud. All my colleagues at Targus Info would recognize as, you know, something that someone had really done well. And so with that, we've carried that forward at RunSafe to recognize employees who've done great things and earned a bottle of whiskey from the American Distillery Company called Courage and Conviction to recognize their efforts and their willingness to plow the dirt with their face.
Oh, wow, that's great. It's awesome. It sounds like you've got a really good company with a lot of loyal employees, you know, and in today's culture, it's hard to find. But anyway, let's move on to more macro level now of cybersecurity and technology. You know, when I was back at school at Purdue, you know, in the 80s, cybersecurity wasn't even thought of. You know, everybody, you know, Windows 95 was a big thing coming out. But now cybersecurity, technology, security, it pretty much intersects in everything that we do with life and even in the political realm too. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it really has become, you know, a key element, not only in the great competition that's emerging between the United States and China. But even historically, the investment in technology to modernize, to invest in research and development, to invest in technology and science, to invest in innovation, that aspect that fuels our economy, especially in today's world, but even historically, innovation and science and technology has fueled, the economies of great countries. And today is no different. And the adoption of new technology, the innovation that's done to solve new problems as science is better understood and how it gets applied, really leads to the strength of a country and the strength of, a country's military. And so in World War II, great, tremendous innovation occurred technology-wise during the war. And with that, it really kind of set the stage when the U.S. emerged as the leader of the international world order coming out of World War II. It was really on the heels of our technology innovation to win the war, if you will. And that has carried us forward very well. And today, that investment in technology is born, not just by the government, not just by think tanks or academia, but also by the venture capital community. And part of the United States strength is all the investment that that venture capitalists place into our startup ecosystem. And it's one of the things that sets us apart. So I think the race for continued technology dominance, to continuously discover new breakthroughs in science, all the things that we can learn from research and development that we have, whether it's connected to a use case or disconnected, and it's really just understanding basic science. It's some of the most important things to help sustain the power of a country to maintain leadership and economic prosperity for everybody. So I think technology is fundamental at the intersection of geopolitics because it gets to the heart of who's going to win the race, if you will. And I think we're in a pretty significant competition with China on many different dimensions in technology. If you think of quantum computing or 5G technology simply cybersecurity and the tech wars that are going on between companies. If you think about artificial intelligence and generative AI and ChatGPT, these are profound. These technologies have a profound impact on how society develops and who's going to control, how commerce is done. And so I think you can imagine if China had its way and was able to dominate the 5G landscape to fuel e-commerce and connected devices that are interacting with, companies to make purchases and conduct transactions. And at the same time, China has an amazing surveillance technology and artificial intelligence to understand what's happening. And maybe they understand what kids are doing through TikTok and other social platforms. That there is, you can see that the power of technology is essential to understanding what's going to happen in the world. And I, for one, am, in favor of, kind of a liberal-based world order that allows for interdependency of countries to interact and interact freely. And I don't want to see those basic principles disappear. And I think technology is at the heart of that. And so I think some of these issues that we face today and where China is investing in their R&D and their future and where the United States and Europe and other places are investing in our future, I think there's a lot to be, had in terms of the way the international world order will operate in the future. And so I hope our country continues to invest in technology. We continue to advance and we maintain that position that we have of leadership to help, maintain a world that has, free democratic institutions and countries. And technology is right at the heart of the intersection of all that.
Excellent. Now, as we wrap up, as we are now the last part of our show, just a couple of other topics I wanted to bring up with you. We had talked about the Internet of Things earlier in the show, and honestly, I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy. I drive like a very old car. I don't have a smart home or anything. What do you think about the IoT and the way it's evolving in terms for the business as well as for the consumer here in the U.S.? I mean, do you have a smart home or a smart car? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say that it's pervasive, and I know there's a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily adopt all the connected devices, but if you think about a smartphone and the power of computing on a single device and all the forms of interaction, you know, it's your alarm clock, but it's your phone, it's your camera, it's your web browser, it's your email client. And, you know, add in the next top 100 applications that you use on your smartphones. And those connected devices create value add. So, for example, I wanted to replace the propane gas tank that I use for grilling. It's, you know, coming out of Memorial Day. I wanted to, you know, make sure I didn't run out of propane gas tank. I logged onto my iPhone. I recorded a request for a new delivery of propane gas tank. And the very next day, this morning, my empty tank was picked up and a new tank was dropped off. That's a transaction that, you know, you would otherwise do, you know, in some other way. If you think about ordering food, ordering rideshare cars and other things, there's all sorts of automation that's occurring around us. But when you look at IoT and look at operational technology, one of the big drivers in today's world is modernizing that infrastructure and modernizing the way, basic services in our country are done. So in the old days, there might be a crank that opens a dam and someone has to physically turn it or somehow physically turn it. Today, you can press a button and that, you know, that dam can open and it's because it's been digitized. It's been, software has been used to help automate that. Same thing with traffic lights. The same thing with, traffic reports. There is all sorts of automation going on around us. And it's these connected devices that help try to make the world a little more efficient and a little more convenient. And naturally, they come with a little more risk in that they are connected. Right. And so cybersecurity, as we modernize our technology and our, infrastructure, to, improve the efficiency, cybersecurity becomes even more important. So I like to say sometimes that there is no mobility without some form of security, and cybersecurity is a great aspect of that. And I'll say one thing. In the 1930s, the Rouge plant produced just south of Detroit used to employ 105,000 people. And today, it only employs about 3,500 people, but they've quadrupled the number of cars that get produced in a day coming out of that same plant. And now part of that is, innovation in the supply chain. They, a lot of the parts are not made from raw materials there at the plant anymore. It's been, kind of built out and optimized through a series of members of the supply chain. But that supply chain couldn't support the assembly plant without connected technology, without data interaction, without, some form of industrial automation that would enable all those working components, all that distributed complex supply chain without a form of technology. And so, the Detroit area has thrived throughout the years, economically because of the innovations that are made in the auto industry. And a lot of people might think, oh, that sounds ridiculous. The auto industry suffered, tremendously in the 70s and 80s. But Detroit has recovered nicely recently, and it has, all sorts of new technology and things that are fueling its growth. And so I think the technology for society is inevitable. I think that, all those personal ways that we interact are somehow assisted by technology. And we need to be mindful of the ways that we need to protect the consumer, protect the individual, protect the industrial operation, protect the business through security. And so technology is a great efficiency operationally, and we need to make sure we protect those operations through good cybersecurity.
Excellent. Now, finally, AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning, it's been around for quite a long time, you know, probably since the 1950s and even 60s. But right now it's making all the hysteria because of ChatGPT and so forth. What are your thoughts on AI? Do you think it's going to be a good thing, bad thing? It's going to replace jobs? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think all technologies have kind of a dual use. It can be a tremendous upside and a tremendous downside. And, you know, the important thing, though, if you put it in the broader context of, you know, geopolitics and things like that, if we don't continue to invest, then our freedoms may be greatly restricted going forward. So in a macro sense, I think technology advancement is a great thing. And yes, it creates some harsh moments that require, you know, new jobs training. You know, there may be, you know, layoffs that come, and we need to find ways to, you know, help people get back into the workforce in perhaps slightly different ways, or, you know, through new training and things like that. But in particular with AI, with large language models, there's no doubt that ChatGPT is going to be one of those disruptive innovations on top of, as you say, decades of advancement in artificial intelligence and machine learning and the like. And the ability to process large data sets and to comprehend the language models and to apply large data sets to those complex language models is a tremendous breakthrough. And it can lead to greater efficiency, greater automation, and greater, you know, economic prosperity in general. And along the way, we must find ways to help people adapt their careers to apply, you know, their skills maybe in different ways, especially if some of their skills, you know, or their jobs or roles, you know, get downsized. And so I think it's one of those great conundrums. You know, how do you advance society when there are individuals that might, you know, suffer some of the consequences of a transition to a new world? And what guides me is the idea that, you know, we want to maintain our freedoms, our liberties, and we certainly need to invest in education and help people with jobs and find new jobs that, you know, if their job gets automated away. And so with that, I think it's essential that we continue to evolve. It's essential for economic prosperity of our country, and it's essential for individuals. I think of, you know, this question going back to history, and when, you know, there were quilt makers and the like, and, you know, garments and things, and it used to be a factory of seamstresses and sewers could make great quilts. The problem is somebody came up with a way to make quilts with machinery. And the UK at the time, the British Empire, did not want to, you know, put people out of jobs. They did not want to adopt the technology. So they refused to issue patents for the inventor of this quilt automation machinery. And after three attempts, the person got frustrated and went to France. And France not only issued a patent, but they helped fuel you know, that person's adoption of the or deployment of the technology. And unfortunately, in that particular case, the individuals that worked in those factories all of a sudden had products that were more expensive, that were slower to make, and, you know, in some cases weren't even as good of quality. And so it's a lesson of, you know, if you don't do it, somebody else will. And unfortunately, that is the case. And I think in this particular case, you know, somebody else could be China, and China could, you know, start to dominate some of these areas, and their world order could take over. And so I just use that lesson in history to think about, you know, is it good to advance technology? And I think in general it is. Now, the downside, aside from loss of jobs and things like that, there could be technology that's used for nefarious reasons. And I do think in the case of ChatGPT, tremendous transparency in language models and what data sets are used to train these AI engines is essential. And I also think, you know, overall understanding of ethics and code of conduct are also essential. And I am all for, you know, just like we have in the atomic energy space, in the AI space, I think there will be a time where we need international standards for how technology is adopted and what it can do and how to avoid, you know, nefarious means of action taken by technology. So I think in all cases, there is the potential for dual use, you know, positive and negative uses of technology, and we need to guard against the downside risks, whether that's through training or, you know, standards to ensure that we don't misuse technology in the end.
For sure. I think the Biden administration, I think they came out with some kind of thing like the AI Bill of Rights or something to protect consumers from nefarious uses of AI. But anyway, Joe, it was good.
Absolutely.
What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they have more questions or they want to use your services?
Yeah, they can reach out to runsafesecurity.com. There's a bunch of different ways to interact with our company. You can join our Slack channel. You can join, you know, you can email us. You can fill out a form on our website, and you can call us directly. So if you go to runsafesecurity.com, all of those options are available. And if you are looking to solve, you know, security needs across your infrastructure, then we're a great partner to understand your needs and help you out.
Well, thanks for your time, Joe, and we look to having you on future podcasts.
Thanks, Robbie. Thanks for everything. Take care.
Bye-bye.